This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Welcome to Through the Ringer. I'm your host, Tate Frazier. It is Friday, and it's a beautiful Friday because we got Brian Curtis on the show. But first, we got a friend of the show, friend of the program, whatever you want to call him. He is the host of many shows here at the Ringer. He is John Jastrzemski. JJ Bombs, good to see you, man.
Hey, it's good to be back. It's a great time of the year. Hopefully, the spring weather is turning here in the New York tri-state area. And we got a lot of basketball to break down. We have the baseball season upon us, and we know the NBA and the NHL playoffs are right around the corner. So fired up, dude. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to be with you, too. It's opening day. Some people are calling it opening night at this point, but we can get to the baseball a little bit later. Let's start with the Sweet 16, JJ, because we got some great games here on a Friday. And we're going to start in Dallas in the South region. We got Houston taking on Duke. This is going to be a great game. Ian Eagle on the call. Jim Nance in the crowd. What do you expect to see in this one? Houston minus 4.5 here.
You know, I look at Houston, and to me, their game against A&M, you could look at it one of two ways. You could say, wow, they were fortunate to win. You know, A&M missed a zillion free throws. A&M comes back at the end of regulation. Houston, should we be worried about them going into this game against Duke, where Duke, to their credit, played lights out in Brooklyn? I mean, they destroyed Albany or Vermont. I'm getting my America East team screwed up. They destroyed Vermont. Maybe right. That's a little PTSD from Syracuse in 2005. But then the James Madison game, you had everybody, Tate, rushing to the window to go and bet the 30-plus win team. I didn't buy it. I was all over Duke. That was one of the few games we actually got right last weekend. But I thought that was a layup, and they won the game by 20-plus points. Look, if Duke is going to shoot the ball the way they did in Brooklyn, specifically in that James Madison game, in theory, you would think they're going to be alive and well. I kind of look at it the other way here. I just think Houston got their scaring around the 32. They know full well what happened to them last year at this particular point in time when they were in the Sweet 16 and got bounced, and they were sick to their stomachs about that. And I just think their defense and what they bring on the perimeter is going to overwhelm Duke here. The eye test, I'm not going to let it fool me here, Tate. I know a lot of the metrics are working in Duke's favor. I know a lot of the sharp money, quite frankly, is working in Duke's favor because the public can't wait to come in and bet on Houston here. But I'm siding with Joe Public. I think the Cougars are better. I think they're on kind of a vengeance tour to get themselves to the Final Four, and I think they find a way to get it done.
Yeah, fifth straight Sweet 16 for Calvin Sampson and the Cougars. The total in this game, 133.5. Do you like the under here? I feel like this game, because of that defense, second-best defense in the country, they're going to slow things down, and I could see the under hitting in this one.
Yeah, I think that's a good correlation. I like it. I think if you're on the side of Houston especially, I think Houston and under kind of work side by side. I think for Duke, they're going to look to get this game up-tempo. Mm-hmm. Can they do it, though, and can they keep up with Houston, who obviously can run and gun, and they can find a variety of different ways to attack the basket and whatnot? I'm on the Cougars here, but I'll ride with you on the under. I'm totally game with that.
I like it. Houston, we're going to take Houston. We're going to take the under. The next game in Dallas, we got Marquette, NC State. This is a matchup of the 1974 NCAA title game. Marquette minus 6.5 in this game. The total, 151.5. Do you believe in the Cinderella? Can DJ Burns and NC State make a run here, JJ?
So NC State has been so much fun, Tate. You know, I'm at a sports book over the weekend You had everybody and their mother on Oakland on the money line, and I'm rooting like crazy for DJ Burns, and I'm rooting right. like crazy for Kevin Keats' North Carolina State team that won five consecutive games in the ACC tournament. They go and they smoke Texas Tech, and they survive in this game against Oakland. Now, that all being said, I think the odds makers kind of gave you an indication on where this particular matchup is going, because they had no problem, despite the fact that, hey, NC State has been a cover machine. They've covered seven of their, you know, last seven games. Odds makers say Shaka Smart and Marquette, they're 6.5-point favorite. I love DJ Burns. He's so much fun. He's got like that baby Zeebo vibe to him. But I think Marquette is going to pick and roll him to death. I think they're going to expose him in a lot of matchups. I think the fact that Kolick is back and he's got his mm-hmm. sea legs here. They won a tough game against Colorado in the round of 32. I think the line here, and I'm a little concerned about Marquette's depth because they're not a particularly deep team. So if they find themselves in foul trouble, I might be sweating this out. But I think this is where the one Cinderella and the one double-digit seed of this tournament says sayonara. I think Marquette makes a statement. I'll take the Golden Eagles. I'll lay the points.
Yeah, I think, you know, in the last round, you mentioned the Colorado game, Eddie Lampkin, who's very similar to DJ Burns, he had a lot of trouble with that pick-and-roll game that Tyler Kolick was running. He kind of targeted him as much as he could. I feel like he's going to do the same with DJ Burns. So I think there's a bit of a blueprint there for Marquette, and they are a bit of the Spider-Man meme, these two teams. They're built the same way. They have similar philosophies. They want to press. They want to push when they can. So I think it's going to be a really good basketball game. A lot of people think this could be a blowout. How do you feel about that? Do you think this is going to be a blowout, or do you think it's going to be a close game?
I would lay the points. I think it's double digits. I do. I think it's a double digit type margin. And, you know, Tate, for what it's worth, I think if you like NC State in this game, I don't think they lose close, man. I think if the game is close, I think NC State, with all that juju they have going, they find a way to pull through, and then we're sitting there at the end of the game saying, holy smokes, I can't believe the Wolfpack of NC State are playing in the Elite Eight. So I kind of think this is a Marquette by double digits type of game. And if it's close, I think we might be talking about the underdog winning outright.
Yeah, it could be interesting. Just looking at the South region, looking at those odds, Houston the favorite, obviously, plus 100, Marquette plus 200, Duke plus 350, NC State plus 1400. It does feel like NC State has talked themselves into being a team of destiny. Houston, after surviving A&M, they kind of have that same DNA. If you had to sort of, if we did get to a point where it is NC State, Houston, would you then be on NC State? Would you finally buy into them being the team of destiny? Or would you go back to Houston?
Well, I mean, if you have NC State Houston with all the storylines,
right, 1983,
Slamma,
right,
the late, great Jimmy Valvano, Derek Wittenberg, the pass, the shot, whatever you want to call it, then maybe you might be thinking that NC State totally has the karma on their side. But you mentioned those odds. I think if you're going to hop on anybody right now, I think the value, in my opinion, would be on Marquette at plus 200. And I say that because I don't think you'll get Marquette at plus 200 if they're matching up with Houston on Saturday. I think that line would be pretty tight. I think you'd be looking at a three and a half point spread, give or take. So if you're confident that Marquette's going to beat NC State, now you missed the best of the number. I understand that. But if you want to have a little fun over the course of the weekend, I think the Golden Eagles at plus 200 is nice value. And listen, I know a lot of people are going to fire on that Duke Final Four ticket because they're going to say, wow, Duke's hot. They're Duke. I'll get them at plus 400. I don't know. I think the odds makers telling you how they feel about this matchup with Duke being at that particular number.
FanDuel has some more props. South Region top point scorer. The favorite is Cam Jones of Marquette, plus 250. Tyler Kolick, plus 500. LJ Cryer, plus 1,000. Jamal Shedd, also plus 1,000. DJ Horn from NC State, plus 1,100. Emmanuel Sharp, plus 1,400. I think there's some value there taking Emmanuel Sharp. He just had 30 points in their last game against A&M. Fouls out in overtime in that game. But at plus 1,400 to be the top point scorer in the Sweet 16 and the Elite Eight, I kind of like that for Houston because I feel like they're going to be around for both games. What do you think about that, JJ?
I totally understand that value play. I look at Kolick more myself.
Plus 500.
I think you have to identify, Tate, for the prop market, somebody you feel confident is going to be playing in both of these games, you know? So that's where we talk about this when we do the NFL playoff stuff, when you find like most passing yards and a lot of this other mumbo jumbo. you really have to kind of see the future. So you're in it sharp at Houston. I'll roll with the all of a sudden resurgent and hot Tyler Kolek at Marquette.
I like it. I like it. So we got some good value here in the NCAA tournament. I want to look at just the national championship odds. You know, we do this as we, you know, get into January, February to kind of see where things lay out. Right now, Connecticut is plus 200. They are the favorite. Right behind them, Houston, plus 600. They also have another prop here, Connecticut versus the field. Connecticut plus 200, the field minus 300. Is it worth, are we at the point, JJ? Are you there yourself? Grant Hill obviously is, if you listen to the broadcast. He thinks it is UConn versus everybody else. Do you feel it's that way? And if it is, do you take UConn plus money to win it all right now?
So I think UConn's the best team. They're the champs. They have this swagger about them. They're just blowing the doors off of everybody. But hey, I'm not a chalk guy. Mm-hmm. So everybody in their bracket pool had UConn. I couldn't do it. Maybe that's the Syracuse guy within me that might be talking here. I wanted to find some value. Now, by no means would I suggest laying minus 300 on the field. I'd be careful with that one. But when you could have gotten UConn at a way better number earlier in this thing, I just don't think you're getting any juice at plus 200. I think you're better off. You like UConn, keep betting them to win these games. And I think that's a better way to play it. But you know the NCAA tournament and the history of it.
Mm-hmm.
I do as well. At some point, UConn is going to be tested here. I don't know who it's going to be against. Maybe it's the winner of Iowa State and Illinois. Maybe it's you got to wait till the Final Four, and maybe it's your North Carolina Tar Heels. You got to have a legitimate big who's going to be able to bang with Klingon. That is a must. If you don't have that, UConn is going to absolutely torch you. So to me, if I'm looking at teams that could give UConn a run for their money, the two that obviously jump out are two number one seeds. Your Tar Heels, because mm-hmm. they play defense. They're very experienced. They have Davis, who could go and take the game over. And Big Cod has played in 10 zillion NCAA tournament games. And then the other team I would look at, and I know they don't have a history of being in the quote-unquote circle of trust, but I think you have to look at Purdue because of Edie and because of their wings. And, you know, maybe it's the 2018-19 Virginia type of narrative where they lose to a 16 seed and they go and avenge it in a big way in the tournament. Looking at the field right now, Tate, those are the only two teams I see beating UConn. Could make a case for Creighton. I think Creighton would have to shoot an insane percentage from three to have a chance in that game. Like insane. They'd have to shoot like 55-60%. And they've beaten UConn before. They also got smoked by UConn. So I put them a distant third, but Purdue and North Carolina, if anybody's going to do it, I think it's those two teams.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about the Blue Jays when we come back right after the break. Stay tuned. We'll be back with JJ, and we're going to talk about the other two matchups in the Sweet 16.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. I was traveling internationally last year. I was in Mallorca. I didn't know the island well. I said, let me head to the north, head towards the water. Let me go on hotels.com and see what they have available. Something preferably on the beach, maybe even a gym. Not only did I get those things, there was a kids session with exercise, gymnastics in the water, pony rides, a train. It had everything, and I didn't even want any of those things. But at least I knew they were there, just in case I changed my mind. And now finding the perfect hotel has never been easier thanks to the Hotels.com app. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly, right, all-inclusive, or a relaxing spa weekend, you can find exactly what you need and compare hotel prices, ratings, and amenities side by side. So start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app.
Welcome back to Through the Ringer. We're still here with John Jastrzemski, and we are trying to our best to break down the Sweet 16 and give you the picks that you need to hear. JJ, we got Creighton taking on Tennessee. We got Greg McDermott versus Rick Barnes. This Midwest region, a lot of coaches trying to get over the hump, a lot of coaches that get a lot of grief when it comes to March Madness. But Creighton, Tennessee, the first one we're going to talk about, Tennessee -2.5 in this one, the total 144.5. What say you, JJ? What do you like here?
You nailed it, Tate. It's the tortured souls region where you have Matt Painter at Purdue mm-hmm. and you have Rick Barnes at Tennessee. And the narrative is exactly the same with those two coaches. They can't win the big one. Yep. Well, in this particular game, I think the futility will continue for Rick Barnes and Tennessee. And I know he has Kinnett, and I know he's special, and I know he can go and take a game over. But I can't ignore something that you have here with Creighton as far as being a top 30 offensive, defensive efficiency type of team. And full disclosure, Tate, my worst beat of the tournament, not even close, hands down, was Oregon. +5.5 the other day against Creighton. I am still sick to my stomach over it. Although
rightfully so.
It's such a conflict of interest, though, Tate, because I had Creighton for the Final Four at the beginning of the tournament. I have Creighton to win the region. I have a national title bet on them. But yet I loved Oregon. Like, the line opened at 7, and it's down to 5.5. Then it fell at 3.5. And I'm like, this is going to be a game. This is going to be one possession, team with the ball last going to win. Well, that almost played out that way. But why do I bring all of this up with Creighton? I bring it up because I think when you win a game like that, where you are dead to rights, you are deader than dead as Oregon is going to the foul line. They're up 4 with 24 seconds to play, and you survive. I almost think in many ways, Tate, it gives you a new lease on life as a basketball team. And I think you're going to see that from the Blue Jays. I think they're going to shoot the ball very well. I think they'll be able to establish things down low. And I think they'll do enough to keep Kinnett in check. I'm taking Creighton. I don't even need to mess with the points. This is where I'm sticking with my bracket pick. Creighton, money line. That's what we're doing in this game.
Yeah, I like the Blue Jays. You mentioned that. I mean, last year, FAU, they win that Memphis game, right? And then all of a sudden, they go on this magical run. They get to the Final Four. Creighton is one of those teams last year. The ball did not bounce their way. They wanted to get to that Final Four. They'd come up just a little bit short. So they do have this kind of feel where they're trying to get over the hump. They feel like they're supposed to get over the hump. I like what Ashworth's been able to add to this team. He was the big difference there. Baylor Shireman versus Dalton Connect is going to be a great matchup in this game. I mean, you talk about two shot makers, two creators. But, I mean, Tennessee, they won ugly, JJ, and it was an uninspiring win. So I feel good about that Blue Jays pick. I think that's going to be a good one. Next up, we got Gonzaga-Purdue. Purdue -5.5 in this one. Total 154.5. We saw these two teams play in Maui earlier this season. Gonzaga started out well in that game, but it ended up going sideways. And then what do you like here, JJ?
This game is really, really tricky because Gonzaga looks so impressive against Kansas. But, Tate, then you hear in the comments regarding Bill Self saying, yeah, I've been looking forward to next season for the last few weeks. Then I have to wonder, well, how impressive really was it for Gonzaga, what they were able to do in the second half? Look, these teams played Maui early in the year. Purdue took it to them. Mm-hmm. Now, I think Gonzaga is a much more complete, and I think they're a much more comfortable offensive team than they were back in November. But I still think they have the same challenges in this particular matchup. I just think Edie is going to be too much for them. This is where I am going with one of these tortured coaches, because I know Purdue played Utah State. I know the Mountain West Conference was incredibly overhyped, incredibly overrated, and really just embarrassed themselves in this tournament outside of San Diego State. That all being said, they made Utah State, who smoked TCU, they made them look like freaking 16 seed in that game. And I just expect that Edie and the sharp shooting prowess of Purdue is going to be too much here. I think we'll have a game, Tate, competitive for a half, height maybe going into that 10-minute mark, and then you'll see the Boilermakers pull away here. And I think it's telling. Line has moved up a full point. Kind of got split action on the game. I know Gonzaga is a respected team. Mark Few is one of my favorite coaches in the country. But I just get the sense it's Purdue's time. I'll take them. I'll lay the lumber.
Yeah, it does feel like Zach Edey needs to get to a Final Four. You know what I mean? After losing to a 16 seed, as far as the legacy, because he could go back-to-back player of the year. And if you don't have the accolades for the team, you know, beside that, it kind of gets into this weird convoluted conversation. Just look at the Midwest region here. Purdue, the favorite, +120. Tennessee, +210. Creighton, +450. Gonzaga, +500. I like the front court of Gonzaga. I like what Ben Gregg has been able to add coming into the starting lineup. I think they have enough horses to kind of deal with it. But the real thing that you come back to is Ike's foul trouble, and I do think Edie's going to get him in foul trouble. So is there value just taking Purdue there at plus 120, or like what say you when it comes to this region? Because it does feel like it's Purdue's to lose, in my opinion.
Well, I think you're right about that, but we're talking about value, so mm-hmm. it's a little bit of a different conversation. Hey, I got to roll with my pick that I had at the start of the tournament, Creighton. Creighton, who was in the Elite Eight last year, they choked the game away against San Diego State. They brought back a whole lot of dudes with experience. I still think you're getting a good number on the Blue Jays in that four-something range. So value, yeah, it's Creighton.
Yeah, and if we believe in Creighton, Midwest region top point scorers, Edie is the favorite, minus 105, Connect plus 480, Graham Ike plus 1,000, really interesting there as far as the odds, but Baylor Shireman plus 1,400, Trey Alexander plus 1,600. If you do believe in the Blue Jays, one word, Blue Jays, do you take either Shireman or Kalkbrenner or Alexander? They're all plus 1,400, plus 1,600 to be the top point scorer in this region.
I don't hate rolling with Shireman because mm-hmm. you're kind of banking on him getting really hot over these next two games. And he's going to have to shoot a whole lot of threes to go and win this game against Tennessee. And especially if they go and match up with Purdue on Sunday. So I like that. I do.
I like where your head's at, JJ. Let's turn the page here. Let's talk about baseball a little bit. Opening day is happening. Some people are calling it opening night. Just general thoughts about the baseball season. How are you feeling? Are you excited for spring? And are you excited for baseball to be back in our lives?
Listen, living here in New York City, hosting New York, it's always great having a Yankee team with a whole lot of star power. And the idea of watching Aaron Judge and Juan Soto in the same lineup day after day is rather appetizing. And baseball now has found themselves in a situation where the regular season has really been watered down. It doesn't matter as much, quite frankly, if you go and win your division. I mean, just look at what has happened the last 2 years. The Phillies going to the World Series 2 years ago. Last year, you had Texas and Arizona coming out of the wild card round. So basically, with the way the sport is set up, you got to be hot at the right time, and you just have to be a part of the tournament. The good news is, with six teams going to the playoffs in each league, Tate, there's a lot of opportunities to go and find yourself in the tournament. I have fired on a bunch of future props. My World Series pick, for what it's worth, it's going to be rather convenient for media members. I got the Orioles in the American League, the addition of Corbin Burns, super young and dynamic lineup. I think they'll add at the trade deadline. I got Baltimore and Philadelphia, and I got the Phillies over the Orioles in the 2024 World Series.
I like that pick. Orioles plus 1,400 to win it all. The Philadelphia Phillies there at plus 1,500. I got one Yankees special, regular season special, I want to throw at you to see what your thoughts are. Aaron Judge, Juan Soto, and Giancarlo Stanton to each hit 30 regular season home runs at plus 240. Enough value there, not enough value. Do you think it's possible for those three guys to do that?
Well, if they all stay healthy, yeah, it's a slam dunk. Mm-hmm. But I think that's what you're factoring in here. And I think out of those three, you're going to be the most concerned about Stanton because he played and had arguably the worst season of his professional life. I know he's in better shape. I'm invested, Tate. I took him in my fantasy draft, got him in the 17th round. I couldn't resist. I needed a little bit of pop, but that's why, to me, that bet could go down in flames. Judge, if he plays, is a lock to get there. Soto is a mega lock. Short porch at Yankee Stadium. Contract year. You know he's thinking about those hundreds of millions of dollars that'll be coming his way in the offseason. He's going north to 30. Giancarlo Stanton will make or break the bet, but you know what? At plus 240, Tate, I'm riding. Let's go. I'll take it.
Yeah, I'm riding too. Let's do it. I'll take it. JJ, where can we find all your work? And then we'll let you go enjoy your Friday. Appreciate you joining the show, man.
Yeah, loaded content coming your way. New York. You can find all our New York content there. East Coast Bias with House and Raheem. We have that going on the Ringer Gambling Show on Monday and on Thursday. And of course, you can catch that right here on FanDuel TV.
JJ, you're the best. Thanks so much for coming on the show, man. And we'll talk to you soon.
Tate, anytime. Enjoy those games tonight.
Of course. And coming up on the other side of the break, we have the Ringer's very own Brian Curtis joining us to talk about Iron Eagles' run to the top of college basketball. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
Welcome back to Through the Ringer. I'm still in studio, and joining us now, you know him from the press box. You know him from coming on the show. He's the Ringer's very own Brian Curtis. Brian, great to see you, man.
Always happy to have a one shining moment with you, Dave Frazier.
It's the best time of the year. And lucky for us, you just wrote a great feature. You can go to theringer.com and read this. But ladies and gentlemen, Ian Eagle, let's just start there. You got to interview the voice of the Final Four in his first year. You and I are big fans of Ian Eagle, and this is a great piece. What were your thoughts, and like, what did you expect when you kind of went out and sought this story out from Ian?
Well, it's so funny because you and I both know there are so many announcers now who were raised by other announcers, like Ian's son, Noah.
Yes.
And what fascinated me about Ian is that he was a child of show business, a child of a comedian and a singer. So I thought, well, that's an interesting story, right? How does somebody come from show business and get into announcing? Now, I have no idea if he wants to talk about this or not. So we go out to lunch in San Francisco. This is the beginning of the NBA season. So last fall. And Ian orders an orange Fanta. And I go, wow. And I'm thinking, I've never seen anybody in television drink an orange Fanta. And I look at him and I go, you know, that's a pretty strong order right there. And he goes, well, you know, my dad was on the road a lot. So I was living with these housekeepers. And my dad wouldn't let me have soda. So I convinced the housekeepers to buy them for me while he was out doing comedy. And I'm like, okay, here we go. And from that point on, we talked about his past. That was fantastic.
It's a great story because his parents are both performers. You go into details about how they kind of raised him in front of the audience. And if you ever talked to Ian, as you and I have, and you in so much depth, but he kind of has this way about him where he's very unfazed by the audience. And I feel like that comes when you're someone that's been engaged with the audience for so long. And he started, when he was like 5 or 6 years old? They kind of trotted him out there. He's doing impressions of famous people, you know, Howard Cosell or whoever it is. So he started from a very early age, and that's why he's unaffected by the audience.
Fella, we think Noah Eagle started at a young age, but Ian was 6 in a green corduroy suit on a Catskills nightclub stage.
Crazy.
So think about that.
It is a fascinating story. And now he's in a spot, Brian, where he takes over for Jim Nance. He's obviously been calling the tournament for 26 years. He probably calls, you know, over 100 basketball games a year. So it's not really anything new, but it is new because he's going to be a voice that we haven't heard during the Final Four. When I asked him about that, he seemed very calm and you know, kind of in a very, you know, matter of fact way. What are your thoughts on him kind of stepping into that role, and how do you feel like he will do in his first year being the voice of the Final Four?
He is very calm. You know, one of the times I met him when I was doing this piece, he was doing a KU-ISU game in Ames. So I flew up to Ames, which was exciting because I'd never been to Ames. And he's sitting in a hotel room and he'd been studying players. And while he was studying, he was calling DeJuan Harris, Kansas's DeJuan Harris, DeJuan Wagner in his mind because he's just got so many names of basketball players when you've been calling the sport since 1994. So some of it's just being like, okay, I need to remember 12 new basketball players and forget for the next couple of hours hundreds of basketball players whose names I've thought of before. I mean, just so many crowd in your head. But it's, you know, you're right. Like, he does have this command of the medium. He's not a guy who's ever flustered by anything. And, you know, when I think of him doing a game, I just think of him coming in, sitting down, being ready to go, and being in control in every possible way.
Yeah, and the fascinating part, too, just for him taking this role, I mean, it's obviously a big role. But it did, a lot of times in media, right, people jockey for their position in the space. They want to kind of lobby for themselves to say, I should be the voice of the Final Four. Based on everything that you had in your piece, it sounds like he was the opposite. He kind of just went about his business. He was fine being the second banana. And then all of a sudden, this kind of, you know, was discussed, obviously, at length. But then it's presented to him. But he did not really campaign for himself. Can you talk about that?
He's not much of a lobbyist, no. And in fact, he heard about this about 3 years ago, he told me, that CBS came to him and said, hey, we think Jim Nance will want to step away from this part of his job at some point. We don't quite know when, but when he does, you're the guy. So he did have this kind of in his back pocket in a way. But yeah, when he finally did get the job, when they told him that, Noah Eagle told me that Ian called him, and they talked about stuff, just stuff, for 40 minutes, father-son conversation. And then Ian happened to casually mention that, oh yeah, he was going to be the number one announcer of March Madness. Just 40 minutes in. And Noah's like, but that's not a by the way. That's kind of a big deal in your career when you've never been a number one guy before. But that's how he rolls. That's the kind of guy he is.
That's called burying the lead. And there is going to be a story this weekend in Dallas, obviously. You got, you know, Ian Eagle in the building with the A-team, with Raftery, with Grant Hill, with Tracy Wolfson. But also you got the Houston Cougars, who you mentioned Jim Nance. He is at the games. He is pulling hard for the Cougars. He just had a tough time with that A&M game. But how interesting, Brian, just from, you know, the nerd part of the broadcaster side here, to have Jim Nance as a fan with Ian Eagle on the call, you know what I mean, in the same building, watching and soaking in the same game. That's going to be a lot of fun.
I'll take you up a level of nerdery, too. In the 1980s, before Jim got to CBS, he went to the Final Four to see Houston as a fan, and he watched Brent Musburger calling the games for CBS. So here's future CBS guy watching current CBS guy, whose job he would wind up getting in a couple of years. And now we got current CBS guy and past CBS guy in the same building, and somehow it all involves the University of Houston.
Yeah, and shout out to the Cougars. I know that they're happy to be involved in that situation. Last thing hitting this point, the Final Four. You know, we talk about, you know, broadcasters and what they want to call. The Super Bowl comes to mind. You know, maybe the World Series, whatever it is. Where does the Final Four kind of rank amongst that Mount Rushmore of broadcasting jobs, in your opinion?
It's interesting. You know, I think if you gave Jim Nance true serum, that might be 3 out of 3 for him. And that's because the Masters just has such a personal meaning to him, and he's so associated with that event. And the NFL is the NFL, right? So it's nothing against the Final Four. It's just that, you know, in this day and age, maybe it has a little bit of a different place in the sports landscape. But it's also something, and Ian and I talked about this a lot, that just feels so pure. You know, what he told me is like, when I call an NBA game, the fans arrive late sometimes. The game kind of builds over 4 quarters. He's like, college basketball, you have to be loud as an announcer because the crowd is right there from the tip-off.
Yeah.
Like, no moment of a college game is like, hey, let's go get some soda and some popcorn, right? It's like, it's happening. It's different, and it's special in that way.
And it's also fascinating, at least from when you talk about college sports, I think that, at least in my opinion, it's great when the broadcasters involved have a passion for a college team. He went to Syracuse. He loves Syracuse basketball. He talked about that 2003 title run to me a little bit. Does it ever go back where you're thinking to yourself, I mean, Syracuse, you got Mike Tirico, you got Ian Eagle, and obviously they're known for their journalism school in general, but they're pumping out some of the best of the best and some of the top in the game right now, as they traditionally do.
Tate, I say this, state school guy to state school guy. Mm-hmm. It always pays to be invested in the team and to be able to wear those colors and say, I'm not just a fan. I went there. That is the true mark of authenticity for me.
Right. It hits a little bit different. And we're very excited for the Final Four. Do you have one last thing before we go to break here, Brian? Do you have a team right now? Maybe not even the team that you think is going to win, but just a team that has tugged at your heartstrings a little bit in this tournament. Are you just keeping it Big J? You're just covering it as it all plays out.
Big J. That's a phrase not used at the Final Four all that much. Now, I'm a man without a country, Tate. No Texas. You know, as soon as they went out, I didn't expect him to go very far, but as soon as they went out, I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying the ride.
Right. You got the Rick Barnes game. We won't talk about it, but it was almost there for your Texas Longhorns. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk some of the biggest stories in sports with Brian Curtis. We'll be right back.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome back to Through the Ringer. We're still here with the Ringer's very own Brian Curtis. Brian, we talked about your amazing piece on Ian Eagle, and obviously he is a part of the majestic energy that is happening right now in the sports world. That is March Madness. It is something that you and I enjoy the pageantry of it all. There's a lot of great stories that we've had. Is there one story or one character so far in the tournament that has captured your imagination a little bit? Because there's a lot to choose from.
I think I got the most majestic energy out of Oakland U versus Kentucky. I really did for a couple reasons. I mean, one, sad John Calipari. Amazing. Mm-hmm. And how much did you love it when the Lexington Herald leader misspelled his name on the front page of the paper?
It feels intentional, right, Brian? There's no way that they spelled Calipari with a K without some sort of intent behind it, in my opinion. But, you know, that's a deep dive for another day. But, yeah, there a lot of John Calipari talk in the first round, to say the least.
Yeah, was that a parable about newspapers in 2024 or John Calipari in 2024? Or both, maybe. I love that part of the game, and I also love Greg Campy, the Oakland coach, coming out with Jack Gaulke. Mm. And he said, this man over here, this man, this is why we won the game. This man has no conscience. Now, I think he meant to say, like, he was unconscious from three rather than that Gaulke lacked a conscience.
Yes.
We hope all humans have and all humans playing sports together have. But that was one of my favorite sort of malaprops the entire tournament. No conscience.
I think that's a good one. And Gaulke did kind of become the face of the Cinderella, right? He wins that game. He hits all those threes. He was unconscious, as you were saying, when it comes to shooting the basketball. And he got recruited to do that. Greg Campy basically said when he found him in D2 level, he's like, when you come to Oakland, I need you to take 10 threes a game at the very least. And if you hit four, we're going to win a lot of basketball games. Jack Gaulke kind of lived up to that prophecy. And immediately, Brian Curtis, we see him doing TurboTax ads on his Twitter. He's going and doing interviews. How much have you enjoyed kind of that shift, you know, in college basketball where it's like immediately you become a star and the next day you're doing commercials?
It's the new I'm going to Disneyland, isn't it? Doing right. Your taxes at TurboTax.
I'm going to TurboTax.
It's funny, right? It actually makes an ad kind of fun because you're like, oh, look, this guy deserves it. He, you know, we're happy he's getting the money. That's fantastic.
Well, Jack Gaulke and Greg Campy, Oakland, the little guy, obviously the Davids of this tournament, they kind of in turn became the heroes a little bit, knocking out the blue blood in Kentucky. We love the heroes, obviously, but we do like a good villain as well. Is there a team or a person in college basketball right now or throughout the tournament that has kind of designated themselves as the villain? And is it the defending champs, the UConn Huskies? I'm not sure they're quite villain level yet, but maybe they're trending that direction. I want to get your thoughts on that.
That might be the best answer. And I actually wanted to ask you about this issue because I feel we lost a lot of villains in college basketball quite naturally when players stopped coming back for 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. You did not have that Christian Lettner that you looked forward to rooting against year after year after year. But I thought we also lost another group of villains when this recent crop of coaches retired. The Boeheims, the Coach K's, right? Because in a lot of ways, they were the great villains. They were the guys like, I can't wait to root against you again this year. I cannot wait to enjoy the schadenfreude when you lose and, you know, you get your faces all wrinkled up. And the guy goes, look at him still coaching. Look at him still teaching in this last 2 minutes of the game he's about to lose. So, no, I mean, I don't feel it has one. I mean, UConn may be the answer to that question, but I don't feel there's a great one.
And I don't think UConn really wants to be the villain either. It did feel like at a certain point, Coach K, maybe around 1999, I would say, he was like, I'm okay to be the villain. I'm okay to be the top dog. I'm okay for you to hate me. In fact, the hate fuels me is how I viewed it with Coach K. There's another coach on the women's side that has a very, not similar makeup, but in the sense that I think the hate maybe fuels her. Kim Mulkey had a very interesting week last week. She comes out, she basically preemptively attacks the Washington Post about a feature that they supposedly were reporting on her. She does this whole press conference. environments. We have nothing to base this off of other than her telling us about the story that is coming. One, the press conference, your first reaction. Then two, we'll get into what the story, I guess, potentially could be and where we stand right now.
It was a lot of threats that I've heard before about lawsuits that almost never come true. You know, it's very easy. I'm going to sue that nosy newspaper for peeking into my personal business.
Right.
It usually doesn't happen. A lot of comments about his reporting that were completely unsubstantiated by anybody. And I'm kind of amazed that anybody even repeated them. But yeah, it was just like, you know, let me put on a show. And by the way, that was all a statement that Kim Mulkey was reading and not taking questions about it, which tells you pretty much everything you need to know.
And I mean, you know, we talk about the villains on the men's side. I mean, LSU has sort of become the villains of the women's side, either by choice or just the reality of the situation. I don't know if you want to blame coverage or anything like that, but I mean, Kim Mulkey's got a Coca-Cola, you know, sign up the side of her jacket. She looks like a NASCAR driver. Do you think some of that stuff plays into it? Like, you know, so, like, do they want to be the villains? Does it help LSU to be the villains in this tournament, or are we kind of reading too much into that?
I've never gotten a sense where Kim Mulkey at Baylor or at LSU had any problem with that. It's a little bit like what you're talking about, Coach K. But that is the dynamic I was talking about with the men's game that I think has slipped away a little bit. You know, the players change, but you come back and there are these coaches, and they inspire really strong feelings. That's part of the fun of college basketball.
Well, I want to talk about the art of the halftime interview, too, because I find that very fascinating. We mentioned UConn before. Their head coach, Dan Hurley, his first year being a national champion, obviously one of, if not the best team in the country. You can argue amongst yourselves about that, but I personally think UConn is the best team in the country. But they have been winning these games by a lot, Brian, but he goes into these halftime interviews and he has found a way to find something negative to say no matter what. Have you been impressed by Dan Hurley's spin zone? Because it has been a lot of spinning the opposite direction. He does not want his team to get too high on their horse by any means.
I'm something of a student of these interviews, as you know, Tate.
Yes.
The halftime interview, the end of game interview. And let me tell you, Dan Hurley's been doing some amazing work, even by the standards of the genre. The one where they were up, was it 33 points against Stetson in the first round?
He was gross. He was disgusted. Yeah.
He was disgusted. He's cutting a promo on his team, as they say in professional wrestling. And Tracy Wolfson sitting there being like, I don't know what to do with this. This is entertaining, like way more entertaining than it should be. But I guess my thought was, now, wait a second. I understand going into the locker room and kind of chewing your team out, even when they're way ahead. You know, we're going to need to be better than this to win a title, et cetera, et cetera. But is your team watching the halftime interview on CBS? Is that the place to send the message if you're Dan Hurley?
I think he's playing to his audience, which is the rabid UConn fan base. That's what I would say to myself. But at the same time, I like the idea of him having a TV in the locker room where they're watching him just absolutely rip them before he comes into the actual locker room to rip them. So maybe there's a chance that happens. There are two stories we got from Tracy Wolfson about Dan Hurley that I want to talk about. The first one was him not eating M&Ms in his opponent's colors going into games. Have you heard anything so superstitious and so insane?
Eight M&Ms, wasn't it? Specifically,
yes.
Eight M&Ms that didn't have the other team's colors.
Yes.
It reminded me of a story that I think turned out to be fake about Barack Obama, that he would eat exactly seven almonds every night. That was part of Obama's discipline, it was said. So it reminded me a little bit of that. I'm not only going to avoid the colors, which is kind of old school sports superstition, players eating chicken before baseball game, that kind of stuff. It was kind of very abstemious. Like, if it were me, I would eat the whole pack of M&Ms except for the other team's colors. I wouldn't be able to stop at eight.
Yeah, superstition is a is something that we see in sports across the board. I got my lucky Carolina socks on right now, so you know what I mean. We all do very strange things. One of the strangest things that Dan Hurley apparently does, his wife, this is according to Tracy Wolfson, great report by her, his wife brings a portable washing machine to the game. She washes his suit. She washes his underwear that he's been wearing since last year's tournament, and they make sure that it's all clean and ready to go in between each game. Ian Eagle was – he was shocked to even hear that portable washing machines existed. Is this the most fascinating story we've heard throughout the tournament as far as sideline reports?
And it's underwear with Red Dragons.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Red Dragons, exactly.
Red Dragon underwear. I, too, was fascinated by that you can bring a washing machine to a hotel room. We've all been there, right, where you've just been there for a couple of days. You know what? I need a little bit of a refresh here. and I don't quite know what to do. So I think I am impressed on the level of superstition and also impressed on the level of technology you want to acquire such a machine.
Apparently, it's huge on TikTok, Brian Curtis. I have no idea, but apparently the portable washing machine is a big ad on TikTok. One last thing about the halftime interview. I don't know if you caught this, but it is very fascinating, at least from someone like me that covers college basketball. John Rothstein, CBS broadcaster, he's doing the sideline reports, but he's also, he wades in the water of being a take artist, as people do in today's media climate. So he has takes on the ACC throughout the year. They're not very flattering takes about the ACC, as you can imagine. But now he's doing halftime interviews with Brad Brownell, who has kind of been the one championing the ACC throughout the year. And it is very awkward. He's asking questions. Brad Brownell does not want to be talking to him by any stretch of the imagination, but he kind of has to because of the broadcast. Did you pick up on any sort of the awkwardness there? Because it was very funny for someone who's kind of in the weeds watching.
Again, as I say, as a student of these things, anything you can get out of them. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. Awkwardness, I'm all for, because it's better than, you know, we'll get them in the second half, have to regroup, have to move the ball better. I mean, these are terrible interviews, Tate, by and large. So I will absolutely take awkwardness and grudges.
Anyway. Yeah. A lot of grudges that are happening on the sidelines these days. Shout out to our guy, Jim Lampley, for making the sideline reporter a gig in the modern media. We learned that years ago back on the press box. I want to talk about the biggest story right now, maybe in sports. Shohei Ohtani, this is a story you talked about on the press box. The access, being able to access this story and report on this story and be able to kind of get people engaged in this story is a very difficult process because of the language barrier, because of how kind of insulated Shohei is in general. What would it take for us to finally get that big feature that breaks down what's going on here? Or are we always going to kind of live in this weird, we don't know what's really going on here kind of world that we're in right now?
That's a great question. I think we're probably going to get something of a definitive answer just because this is such a high value story. Biggest star in baseball, one of the biggest stars in sports, period, American sports anyway, period. And, you know, you have lots of money that was allegedly wired to an illegal bookmaker. Mm. So this is something where that you're putting your aces on if you're the Los Angeles Times, if you're ESPN, if you're the New York Times, et cetera, et cetera. So that's part of it. But, you know, I would say more than anything about the story, part of the reason we've had a problem getting it is because Ohtani's own representatives put forth a story, a version of the story, which was that Ohtani was paying his translators gambling debts that then they later said was not true. So if you want to do anything to get journalists interested in a story and ravenous to break the story, it is to put a version of the story in front of them that doesn't check out. Because all of a sudden it becomes way more interesting, right? And you're like, wait a second. You told us that. Now you're saying it's something completely different. Which one is it? That is the guarantee that you will get people interested.
And I think Shohei Ohtani and the people around him have now discovered the jump, right, from the Angels, where he's kind of in his own universe and his own playground a little bit, and now he goes to the Dodgers, where everybody wants to know everything about you. They want to get into your life. They want to figure things out. For as far as Shohei's sake, like, is it a world in which where now he loses the person that's been closest to him, that's not going to be next to him anymore? And obviously you got all the background stuff there. I mean, is he going to be isolated this year? Like, how is the first year of Dodgers coverage going to look now with this story kind of lingering over the whole team?
It's a fascinating question, because obviously it was more, he was relying on Ipe Mizuhara more, you know, less as a translator, more as a friend too.
Right.
And somebody who'd been with him for a long time. I saw a local news report here where they went out to Dodger Stadium and interviewed fans. What do you think of this? What do you think of this? And they found an Angels fan at Dodger Stadium, decked out head to toe in Angels gear. And the guy was like, well, we dodged a bullet on that one. I'm glad we didn't give him a
pun
bunch
intended.
Of money. I was like, this is the happiest an Angels fan, but it's been in like 10 years. That Ohtani is at least tangentially connected to this whole scandal.
Yeah, so maybe the Angels fans, a silver lining for them. One last thing, Brian, I want to hit. We live in the player podcast era. You and I have talked about this a little bit before, but we have not seen someone at the level of LeBron James dipping their toe into that pool. It is official that he has finally done that. He has joined J.J. Redick. They are breaking down the game. They are getting people. They're minding the game. Is the name of the show. How do we feel about LeBron getting into these waters? Is this like the peak point of the player podcast era? How do we feel about where we are right now?
Well, I'm going to be using some complicated terms in this answer, so I hope you can flash them on the screen so that nobody will be confused when I use terminology. It's an interesting experiment to me. First of all, LeBron James talking basketball with anybody, I think a lot of people are just in.
Yeah, right.
Okay, let's see what we get here. I was interested that it was not, you know, hardcore X's and O's. Hey, we might lose you here, basketball, so much as a little bit of that tucked into a very generalized sports discussion, at least in the first episode, about what makes a great basketball player. I mean, that's the most straight up and down basketball conversation you could ever want to have. I thought the pod was interesting. I thought it was actually best when LeBron was sometimes talking about other players, when he's talking about Jason Tatum and the things he does well and the ways he's improved over the last year. Like, that to me is like really interesting to listen to. It's just like famous people who are really good at what they do talking about other famous people that are really good about what they do. I'll be interested to see where it goes, though, because, you know, it's easy to do a couple of these, I say, as a veteran podcaster, and you are too. But, you know, as you get into it, are you really going to have the interest in talking about this and saying things that could make people upset?
Brian, you're one of the best in the business. We appreciate you coming on the show, and we'll have you back very soon. Thanks again.
You too, Tate. Anytime.
All right, there you have it. Another edition of Through the Ringer. Thanks to Brian Curtis. Thanks to John Jastrzemski for coming on the show. We appreciate you tuning in. Like I said, it is March Madness. Great games this weekend. Tune into those. And we will be back on Tuesday with the Ringer's very own Kevin O'Connor and Sal. It's going to be a fun time. We'll see you on Tuesday.